This work of processing thought and processing communication around thought, and then also understanding that we all arrive with my students arrive in the room with a whole bunch of stuff that I know nothing about, right? And this understanding that they should be able to meet me where I am is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Although I would love it, but you know, it'd make my life be real fast, right? But this is so. I think in the what I learn or how they what they impress upon me is that I have to receive people knowing that I'm. What am I trying to say? Like, I can't take for granted that what I say is something digestible, right? Or that it is understood. And so it's put me in this process of having to really like break down my practice or how I'd like them to practice with me to sort of these nanobites of information, like bit by bit by bit by bit. Because not only am I facing the training that they received before here, I'm facing the way they grew up or the homes they grew up in or the culture that they're in, that they grew up in. And so, you know, people say, you know, dance is universal. Absolutely, it is universal, but it is not practiced in one way. And just because I danced one way or I've trained in one way, that does not cover all bases, right? And I think there is a little bit of a myopia that happens inside of Western dance forms, which is like, oh, if you can do ballet, you can do anything. This is not true. Right? If you can do contemporary dance, you can do any. Like, no, absolutely not, because they have values and they have hierarchies embedded in them. And then if somebody comes from a culture that those values and those hierarchies aren't there, then there's no way that they can engage with the work you're doing. So I think that teaching is, you know, several bites of humble pie. And then it is also like, can you truly articulate, you know, like they say this when you're writing, like, if you can explain it simply, it means you really know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that I'm learning from them. I'm also learning from them that they actually are in the world in a really, really different way than like we're in the same world, but we are in a really different way. So I'm forced constantly. A good friend of mine, Kate Franklin, talks about teaching from the middle, not from the top of the room. And I think this teaching from the middle means that you have to learn how they're in the world. I see this with my kid too. You know, she's 10 and she's living in a different world than I grew up in, for sure, right? So I think that they allow me to process how the work is communicated and how the work is felt, in fact, which I think is our biggest form of communication, right? And so I learn that from them every single day. And some days we find ourselves and we've made a shared language and we totally get what each other's talking about and it's glorious. And then sometimes the next day that falls apart again. So I think they also teach me that inconsistency is just a staple of life.
Yeah. I really like how you answered that, because I think that is something that is kind of commonplace within like the academic Western art world. Like a struggle, or maybe like a blind spot when it comes to effectively communicating art. You know, I think there are a lot of art spaces, whether it's in Vancouver or any other area of North America, where, you know, someone, an average person can go in and see like the writing that describes an exhibit or something and be like, this makes no sense to me. And there's no one there to be like, to, you know, try to meet people halfway. It's kind of like, oh, you don't get it? All right, it's not for you.
Yeah, and this is a tragedy, right? Because in this, I mean, you know, there was this wonderful, I'm a part of a committee at in FCAT that's run by Chantal Gibson, who's a artist and poet and communications prof. And we run this thing every year called Community in Practice, and this year it was about AI. And the woman who runs the Writing Center said to us how actually language is like, writing is an equity issue. And like, it had never occurred to me, which is embarrassing to say, and maybe I shouldn't be saying it so publicly, but this idea that there's a certain kind of writing that communicates in a certain kind of way, and the idea is if you don't get it, you're not allowed in the club, mm-hmm. right? And if you can't get down with academic writing, then there's something wrong with you. But we're not asking, is there something wrong with the writing? Right. And I think that's the question that you're bringing up is like, is there something wrong? Because if you didn't read the didactic and you just went in the room and you saw the thing and you had a million feelings and it stayed with you, well, then the art did its thing. But if you read the thing and then you go, I mean, I'm not one to read programs or didactics until after I've seen the thing because sometimes it ruins it for me because I like the narrative I had in my head about what I was experiencing, you know, and then I read this other thing and I'm like, well, that wasn't happening, right? So, but I wonder about what kind of language we're using or what kind of language actually we feel we need to use to sound like we deserve our position in that gallery on that stage. And you know, I did my MFA. I graduated in 2024, doing my MFA at SFU, at the SCA. And I struggled with the form of academic writing because for me it was a little difficult in the way that it didn't express the values of my work. And I thought, ooh, all of a sudden I have to use this kind of wording, but it doesn't have anything to do with what I'm talking about. So I used footnotes as best I could to like put in the language that I felt needed to be there because I love a footnote. But I thought about that too. I thought, oh, why are we not letting the thing be expressed in the form through words, through language, not the movement part, to reflect what the work is doing and how the work changes a room. And I'm sure there are many brilliant academics who do that. I'm curious about who we leave out when we insist upon, you know, the King's English in a particular form, in a particular order of events. You lay out a thesis and then like I always think about, well, what could we use time differently in someone's reading experience? So yeah. And like I need translators for art too. You know, I do. I don't get everything I look at and I don't always understand what I'm looking at and or what I'm watching. And sometimes those translations do, having a translator of sorts really does help me see, feel, love, enjoy, dislike the work more on either side, right? And then sometimes I'm just left with the feeling of what I saw, which is kind of how I am. Like I'm just like all feeling all the time, you know. But I love that you brought that up because I think if students are listening, like we do need to question those forms, how, you know, and even thinking how AI writes in that form also. And why could it not write in other forms or in other form, like other ways of organizing language?
I mean, it's very embedded, right? So if you have an AI program that that's taught on thousands upon millions of words of academic art writing, that's what it's going to regurgitate, essentially.
Exactly. But I even think about like sometimes my dad corrects my grammar in my texts.
Oh, wow,
Yeah.
really?
Every now and then. My dad is a very good writer, and loves language and loves books. But every now and then, and I'm like, well, you know, it's usually you and I, you and me, or me and you know, this or my child. You know, it's how I use and I or and me. He likes to correct that, and I think, meh, no, the other one was what I meant.
The English is very malleable. It's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think about even. Yeah, my kid not long ago said to me, I was like, hey, we gotta go, like, get your bag, get your coat, get your shoes, get your da-da-da-da-da. And she said to me, Mom, I'm putting the fries in the bag. And I was like, what did you just say? I don't even understand that. And then I was like, then I stopped and I was like, oh, that is such a good expression. Like, I'm almost there. I'm putting the fries in the bag. Like, it's. And I just thought, oh, I love the English language, right? Like when we can be that sort of playful with it. I was like, okay. Having a, I don't even know, Gen Alpha. I don't know what my child is. But there's, yeah, these organized. And of course, language, as we know, is meant to change.
Absolutely.
Like that's how it functions. Words mean one thing at one point in history, and they mean a completely other thing in another point in history, and we've forgotten what they meant before. So this idea that it should be in the state of constant change, like everything else, why not, right?
Okay, I think I had one last question for this
Okay.
interview, and that was, do you have any, like you had kind of alluded to projects coming on the way, but do you have any specific future plans with the resources that this award has afforded you
Yeah, I
that you're
think
able to mention at least?
Yeah, I mean, one of my projects is going to the Fierce Festival. Well, the Brutal Joy is going to the Fierce Festival in the UK, which for me was a real bucket list festival that I wanted to be. I wanted to go to for like 10 years, and it invited. We were invited, and this money. Should I not get my travel grant? This money will allow us to go, even if I don't get a travel grant. And I think that's like. I mean, I would have probably gone into debt to go and do it there. Also, I found out one of my like dearest friends, Dana Michelle, who's like a really incredible dance artist based in Montreal. She's like, "I'm going to Fierce this year," and I was like, "I am going too." So, I feel like just knowing I have this cushion that if for some reason, you don't get grant, you're not guaranteed a grant, and this is kind of something I love about grants. You're not guaranteed anything, right? And you're not owed anything, but this means I will still be able to go. So that's. It's a very far trip to the UK when you live in Vancouver, and those are not
Yeah.
cheap flights. So that's, I think that's the one for me to be able to go do that particular work there, and know that it can happen even if the grant doesn't come through. Feels, wow. Yeah, it makes me feel incredibly lucky. And I feel like that's a great use of that money. And probably, if the grant comes through, then I'll probably just use it to fund the next thing until I get it together to write a grant.
Once again, you are tuned in to Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. That was our interview with Justine Chambers on the 2025 EVA Award that she was recently awarded. And the ceremony for that, I believe, will be at the Vancouver Art Gallery on March 11th. Really awesome conversation and just a really cool person in general. So, was really, really glad to be able to speak with her about that. Coming up before our next talk portion of the hour, we're going to take a bit of a music break. This is from Vancouver band Whack with their track Connected off of their latest album, No One's Watching.
Connected, 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 connected tonight. Connected, 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 connected. I'm feeling connected tonight. I'm hearing of you and you're hearing of me and you're hearing of everyone live. Connected, 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 connected to all of the lives.
Thank you. bird note. Throughout most of the Americas, great horned owls are the preeminent predatory bird of the night, and they are ferocious. Their prowess as hunters depends on acute senses and stealth, but their feet and long curved talons secure the attack. The outermost of their four toes has evolved to rotate forward or backward for handling squirming prey, an advantage that most other birds of prey lack. These feet let the owls capture mammals as large as hares and raccoons. The grip strength in those feet, 200 to 500 pounds per square inch, is equal to that of a much larger bald eagle and up to 6 times stronger than the handshake of a bodybuilder. Talk about a death grip. And these owls definitely don't skip leg day. With strong, thick legs, great horned owls are power lifters. A 4-pound owl can take flight with up to 6 pounds of prey. Their preferred hunting tactic is to perch in a tree on the edge of an open field, listen closely, then drop, flap, and glide silently toward an unwary animal. And from there, those amazing feet take over. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Who doesn't love music? Join the weekly discussion at the CJSF Record Club with other music aficionados checking out new releases and forgotten classics, exploring and learning about genres and loving music. Every Thursday at CJSF Burnaby from 4 p.m. till 5 p.m. Listen, learn, and share.
This is CICK News. Housing Minister Christine Boyle says Smithers is among 7 new BC communities selected for Phase 2 of the Heart and Hearth program, aimed at bringing people indoors and connecting them with supports. The Heart component focuses on outreach and relationship building with people who are unhoused, while the Hearth component provides temporary indoor accommodation paired with connections to healthcare, mental health, and addiction services, and longer-term housing supports.
How does the province assess readiness for something like the Heart and Hearth partnership in these smaller and rural communities such as Smithers compared to larger cities?
So it really begins with a local government reaching out to request either being part of this program or requesting additional resources from the province to help support folks who are vulnerable in the community. And then the province looks to, you know, a number of metrics, including the point in time homeless count and the existence of encampments and the length they've been in place, as well as the willingness of a local government to partner to find solutions together.
And what conversations did the ministry have with regional partners such as Northern Health or Selkant Friendship Center or nonprofits before moving ahead or as part of the sort of holistic picture of deciding to partner with the town of Smithers?
I've been grateful to be able to speak with the mayor a number of times about her and the community's desire to address the encampment that had been in the community to find spaces to safely bring people inside. And that's really what this program is designed for, to be that first step where people can come in and have a safe and dignified place to rest their head, and then to connect with health supports, maybe mental health supports or addiction and recovery supports or other social supports as they are needed to move them along a housing continuum and a recovery journey when they're ready.
Okay, I understand that we're in the announcement phase, but are you aware of what the town of Smithers plans to do in and naming some of those supports that you just mentioned?
That's the part of the conversation we're at now. The Hearth part is the temporary housing part. The HEART part of the program includes a staff person who would be in the community working to do outreach and understand what the needs are of folks who are unhoused or living in encampments in the community so that the service can be shaped around supporting them best.
Yeah. And I guess what timeline does the ministry anticipate for more permanent or year-round housing? You mentioned the emergency shelter in Smithers, which is currently operating until March 31st of this year.
So we are continuing to work on the Alfred Ave permanent shelter. I don't have a timeline on the completion of that, but that work continues alongside the temporary housing that will be part of the Heart and Hearth program.
Maybe this is too localized of a question, but the most recent local homelessness count, it showed a significant increase in people experiencing homelessness in Smithers, with 84% identifying as Indigenous. So how is Heart and Hearth designed to respond to our local demographics and trends?
That's a great question, and that's why we work closely with the local government and local service providers, and why it matters so much that the temporary housing that's part of this program is paired with outreach staff on site so that the supports can be built around what the need is in the community, which may include cultural supports, may include connections to health or social services. All of that is really designed to meet people where they're at, bring them inside to a safe and stable place, and then help build those next steps alongside them. And local staff on the ground and the local community will really know best what that looks like. And the province is there to support that, to invest in the beds and people that are needed to help move folks along.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me.
While the province frames Heart and Hearth as a partnership model, the town of Smithers says the work on the ground is just beginning. In this follow-up conversation, Smithers Communication Director Samantha LeBlanc explains how the municipality formally joined the program earlier this year after years of advocating for additional supports, citing high per capita homelessness numbers and ongoing encampment pressures. The town outlines plans for a public engagement process this summer, and Samantha describes how a local working group will be formed in collaboration with BC Housing, and how the temporary Heart and Hearth response fits alongside the longer-term Alfred Avenue housing project.
So council and staff have been advocating for years for additional support within our community. We formally joined the Heart and Hearth program just earlier this year, around the end of January. We were approached by the province, so that's started in February. And then a lot of the support is based on our community needs. Our latest point in time homeless count, which also is people experiencing housing insecurity, per capita is quite high. I believe it was about 77 people who were experiencing housing insecurity within our community, which is very high for a population of our size.
Do you know how the working group is going to be formulated, or how you're going to do outreach so that the right voices and organizations and perspectives are represented?
So BC Housing has a large part in implementing that. As the municipality, we will help identify any groups within our community. So that includes Indigenous organizations, outreach support, any of the social services we have in town, as well as municipal employees, mm-hmm. For things like, you know, site servicing, engineering, anything like that that they might need.
As the town works with the province to identify a site and also to determine bed numbers, what criteria would be informing site selection, and then also what kind of units this would be?
Yeah, so it really depends on our community need, and BC Housing is very open to exploring that. We don't have any answers on what it's going to look like yet. We are hoping the public engagement part of this will help us identify if there's, you know, some existing buildings in town that might be a good fit, mm-hmm. for kind of a longer term shelter. I do want to also mention, though, that the Alfred Avenue project is more of the long term solution. So just to be very clear on this, it is a temporary support to support our encampment efforts before the Alfred Avenue project is opened, which is expected for 2027 or 2028, which will be more of the longer term.
Mm-hmm. And do you have an idea of the timeline of where we are now, what we should expect maybe even by this summer?
Yeah, so we are working with BC Housing. We're in discussions right now about what that will look like, but we are hoping there will be some kind of public engagement and consultation either summer or late summer. So it will be this year.
We also saw the homelessness count, and it was 84% identified as Indigenous. So I guess, is there an approach that you're using to make sure that service providers are culturally appropriate supports for this temporary build?
So we will be working with a lot of our own local community providers who are already doing this work, and we're just hoping that it'll be able to provide a bit more care. It'll definitely be local supports, people who know what goes on in our community, people who work with these people already, and making sure that they're culturally sensitive to the experiences that these people may have lived.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
For one last time, we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you so much to CICK News in Smithers, BC, and Pam Hassan for that piece that you just heard. Make sure that you stay tuned to CJSF throughout the day. We have a lot of amazing programming from Raccoon City to Typically Tuesdays to later in the night with Slumber Party and Bitcoover. But before all of that, in about a few minutes, we've got Democracy Now! Right at 11 a.m. with Amy Goodman. So stay tuned for that. Thank you all again so much for tuning in. We're going to end off this hour with some more local music, a favorite of this group, who hopefully you will see more of on the CJSF socials. Hint, hint, wink, wink. This is Sour Dope with Water Temple.